Hey everybody, thanks for tuning into the podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by my book, The Toxic Masculinity Crisis. I almost got the name of it wrong. Man, I'm going to have to fire myself as my own spokesman. The Toxic Masculinity Crisis by Dennis M. Brown on Amazon.com. It's about why being masculine is good and why masculinity is good. And how it is to the benefit of us all. Definitely a book for you to read and share with people in your life, young men, young women especially. A lot of confused people out there today. Forgotten what we're doing here. So that'll help. So check that out. It's only $11.99. A steal. So, keep hearing this statistic that half of marriages end in divorce. And whenever I hear statistics that aren't possible to compute, I get upset. So my objection to the whole global warming / climate change agenda has a multitude of causes, but one of them is that the ability to measure the ingredients of climate is unbelievably new. One eye blink ago, we were incapable of measuring that. Ocean temperatures, ocean currents, atmospheric temperatures at different altitudes, places in the world that there were no thermometers until, I don't know, very recently. The ability to measure climate is new. So to tell me that it's dramatically different or changed in any way is silly, because you don't really know. Can't know. So you're taking incomplete data from a long time ago, 100 years ago, let's say, and comparing it to complete data today and saying, oh, there's a problem. Well, you don't know. And I'm not suggesting that polluting is good. My suggestion for the climate change people is they stop talking about doomsday. Oh, climate change. The Marshall Islands are going to disappear any moment. Except that doesn't happen. I had a joke. I used to have a joke about the Marshall Islands. And the joke was that they're like a canary in the coal mine. I heard the president or the prime minister or whatever of the Marshall Islands saying that if the sea levels rose, I forget how far it was, 6 feet, 8 feet, something like that, the Marshall Islands wouldn't exist anymore. I'm like, oh, all right, let's... When the Marshall Islands disappear, then we can all start to worry. But stop with the doomsday predictions, because they are all wrong, because you have no data. You don't have a trend data. You can't set a trend. So just say, hey, polluting the atmosphere is not a good idea. We should mitigate pollution. We should find ways to reduce pollution. All kinds of pollution. There's nobody saying like, no, pollution's awesome. I get that stopping pollution altogether has an economic cost, and we need to balance out the cost economically with our ability to not pollute. But that's all good discussion to have. And people have shown over and over again that you give them the option for something that's a little bit more money but is better for the environment, they choose it, even when it's not. So we got rid of paper bags at the grocery store. Well, they say because we're saving trees. I think they were saving money at the grocery store. But anyway, went to plastic, but now plastic's no good because it's in the ocean. So what's better? Trees you can replant or killing sea turtles? Maybe we should kill the trees. Or then they have these bags you can bring yourself, but then it turns out those things are actually made of plastic too, and they're no good either. The way they make them, there's a bunch of chemicals involved that pollutes. Not good. Or like electric cars. Be like, oh, electric cars are awesome. It doesn't burn fossil fuels. Yeah, except you're getting the electricity to charge your car from a coal power plant. So it's a complicated question. But there's incomplete data. So you can't doomsday. So the reason Al Gore's movie is stupid, that he won the Nobel Prize for, he says the world's going to be over by 2020 or whatever, is because he didn't have good data. The scientists involved in his movie didn't have good data to establish a good trend to say, hey, this is what's happening. So it's not going to turn out the way you think it's going to turn out because you don't know what was going on 100 years ago. Which geologically, or climatology or whatever, is no time at all. So the other one that gets me, the one that got me going today was the idea that half of marriages, or more than half of marriages, end in divorce. That gets thrown around all the time. People have been saying that for years. Well, there's a bunch of stuff wrong with that. One is, we all know somebody, and it's probably your mother-in-law, or, I don't know, a guy you work with, or my old boss was like this, who's been married a whole bunch of times. So if your old boss has been married 5 times, and you have 4 other guys or 5 other guys at work that have each only been married once, you'd be like, oh, half of marriages end in divorce. Because you got 10 marriages, and 5 of them ended in divorce. Except only one guy keeps getting divorced. See what I'm saying? It's a problem. Plus, you have this other issue. Half of marriages end in divorce. Okay, a whole lot of marriages haven't ended yet. How do you account for those folks? Do you have to wait till they die? Like, what if somebody got divorced the day before they died? Or they didn't get divorced and then they just died? When are we counting the marriage as a marriage? I don't think divorce is as common as you think it is, or that a lot of people think it is. I know very few people who've been divorced, but I do know some people who've been divorced a bunch of times, and I think they're messing up the number. So let's say it's like 5% of the population's been married 3 or more times. That's going to destroy the average. And they might only be marrying each other over and over again, so what do you do about that? I would like to know how many first-time marriages end in divorce. How many people married for the first time get divorced? I'll bet you it's 15% or less. And then all the rest of that 35% of the 50% that are getting divorced are people getting re-divorced. They get remarried and re-divorced. One of those statistics. So yesterday I did a podcast on the lady at the New York Times, the racist lady the New York Times hired, and all the idiots that defended the hire, talking about people of color. But it got me thinking about the patriarchy, looking through some of this young lady's former tweets, which I didn't necessarily seek out. People keep retweeting them. She talks tough. And maybe I'm assuming she might be Yao Ming's first cousin. I don't know, but I'm thinking she's tiny. I'm going to go 5'4", 110 pounds. 105 pounds. Little. A tiny person. To somebody like me, a tiny person. And then I think how proud I am of us as a society, as Western civilization, of the patriarchy. That we've created this fantastic society where somebody who weighs 105 pounds, like a 10-year-old child, can say inflammatory things, offensive things, and not be physically harmed in any way. That's a beautiful thing. If you believe in free speech and freedom of expression, people often talk about like, oh, popular opinion, unpopular opinion. Okay, I'm with you. I want people with unpopular opinions to be able to voice them without fear of reprisal, either legal reprisal or vigilante type reprisal. But I also want to live in a society where tiny people, vulnerable little people, can speak their mind just like a giant. So like that guy Mountain from Game of Thrones, 6'9", 380. Giant. He can say whatever he wants. Because he's huge. But I also want to live in a world like little Asian writers that get jobs at the New York Times can say whatever they want. That's the dream of the patriarchy. That the vulnerable are physically vulnerable, are so protected, and they have such a high expectation of protection that they feel free to do and say anything they want. What a wonderful thing that is. That's the patriarchy. For all everybody smash the patriarchy nonsense, that's the patriarchy in action. I've heard people talk before about how atheists say they don't believe in God, but they live like they do believe in God. That's a more of a complex discussion for another day. But I also like that feminists who say smash the patriarchy live their lives like they know the patriarchy is going to protect them, because it is going to. And that's a beautiful thing. And someone, I mean, there's crazy people out there, obviously. There are certain people who are concerned for their physical safety from lunatics. But generally speaking, in Western civilization, you don't have to consider your ability to physically defend yourself before you make a point or act a certain way or say a certain thing or have an opinion. Because the overarching umbrella of the patriarchy is protecting everyone. And it's a beautiful thing. It's this beautiful consensual agreement, generation after generation after generation, a physically powerful and men who are, all kinds of men who are powerful, have influence or political power or wealth or physical strength, competitiveness, cunning, all these things. They have all these raw natural, there's raw natural ability to do harm. And they choose not to. They were taught by their fathers and their fathers' fathers that they should not do harm. And they should look out for other people who might want to do harm and stop them. That's a beautiful thing. So in the midst of all this left-right backlash and crazy communists who hates the white people, the New York Times discussion, I don't want to get lost. I don't want it to get lost. The idea that we've created this fantastic society. We've built something beautiful. And there's a lot of claims that the patriarchy is a tyranny, that it's oppressive to people, it's oppressive to women, but it's not. It's a negotiation. So there are times throughout history where it's been somewhat oppressive because it's leaned a little too hard on physical protection. Or maybe it hasn't. Maybe the physical danger has been so real that the patriarchy had to be that strict and severe. But as those dangers abated, is that the right word? Patriarchy and this collective umbrella of protection has kind of loosened a little bit. And as women express themselves and things that they want, almost all of them are granted to them. It's not a path to the end of the patriarchy. It's not a path to the end of Western civilization for women to be free to marry or not marry, whom they choose or not, go to school and become educated, to vote, none of that. Just an ongoing negotiation of like how protected do you want to be versus how free do you want to be. It's very much like America in that, right? Like there's a lot of people who repeatedly will tell you that every time the government passes a law for your protection, they're taking away some of your freedom. And that's going on with the patriarchy, except it's not really a vote. It's just sort of this silent consensus. It's the same idea. You want to be more free? Oh, all right. Okay, you can be more free. To a point, right? Like, you know, if I lived in Europe, England with grooming gangs, or Cologne, Germany, where on New Year's Eve, I think 3 years in a row, they've had hundreds of sexual assaults by migrants. I gotta be honest, I wouldn't let my daughter go there to go do that. I'd be very concerned, right? There's real physical danger going on. It's a problem, and I think I would be much more protective. I think everyone should. It's not okay to allow the people you're supposed to be protecting so much freedom that they go out and hurt themselves, in some cases in an irreparable way. Sometimes you gotta rein it in. And I know that in today's society, it's not a popular view that men should in any way, shape, or form have any say whatsoever in whether or not women need to be reined in. But that's just where we find ourselves. And I'm not saying they do or they don't. I'm just saying it could get to the point. The world could become dangerous enough that the patriarchy needs to readjust itself and be more protective, which is to say more restrictive about what's allowed and what's not allowed. Well, I'm going to get some hate mail for that one. It's all right. It's all in love. So yeah, the half divorce thing. But I've also noticed recently there seems to be a lot of women, and I should probably have examples. I probably should have researched this and come up with real examples of real people. But rather than make it an accusation, let's just think about it together. It's something you can think about this weekend. A lot of women in their 40s who have a career and aren't married, or maybe they are married and they're childless, and they're very unhappy. And they talk openly about it. They feel like something's missing, or they're empty, or... So it's like these childless, godless women in their 40s, when they're reaching the end of that maternal road and they're unfulfilled. And I can't help but think it's because they were lied to. I could be wrong. There could be a lot of reasons for people to feel unfulfilled at 40. I get it. But I can't help but think that in the quest for female empowerment, the feminist movement has left out the idea that being a wife and a mother is a viable option. That's something that's at least as valuable as having a career, or at least as valuable as having achieved a high level of education. Not that it's for everyone, but neither is a PhD for everyone. But I think it should at least be addressed. Like, that's it's a legitimate path for a woman to want to take. No woman, young woman who wants to be a mother should be ashamed of it. She shouldn't ever have to feel like, oh, I can't do that because I need to have this career because I have all this pressure put on me by the feminist movement or by my parents or whatever, or by this college debt, whatever the case may be. Whatever external pressure she feels to not be a mother, I think is bad. I think the goal of feminism, and it's not my deal. I'm not a feminist, I've said it before. I have no interest in being a feminist. Y'all want to have a fight, go ahead and have it. But it seems to me that if you're going to have a feminist movement, that your goal should be to empower women generally. That the idea should be to put women in a position to make choices. And then be cool with their choices. Don't be hating on women because they decided at 20 they wanted to get married, drop out of college, and have babies. If that's what they want to do, that's what they want to do. You got to be cool with it. Be telling them they sold out or that they surrendered to the patriarchy. Whatever you say. I don't know what you say. Whatever the silent pressure on women is to have a career and to be successful in business or sales or marketing or academia, showbiz, whatever it is. There's a lot of women out there just want to be moms. And that's awesome. And I think they do get support from men generally. I think if you asked 100 men what they thought about a woman who wanted to be a mom, they'd be like, oh, that's awesome. I don't know they get the same support from their sisters out there in the movement. And that's unfortunate. So this is Saturday's episode, but I'm recording it Friday night on the way home. And it is a miserable, gray, rainy day. And it was not a good week this week. I gotta tell you, some weeks are definitely better than others. This was not the best week. But it's the weekend now, and I'm glad. My wife wants me to take her to the movies tonight on a little date. She wants to go see Mamma Mia 2, which is not my favorite thing, but she liked it. So I'm gonna take her. You know, she's a hardworking lady. She's been momming it up all week, driving the kids back and forth to camp and swim lessons and hanging out with their friends and cleaning the house and making meals and all the things she does. So she wants to go to a movie, we'll go to a movie. She wants to see some dumb movie with ABBA songs in it, we'll go to a dumb movie with ABBA songs in it. whatever. You know? What's the big deal? I don't ever pick the movies we go to because, well, none of them look good to me. I liked all the Jason Bourne movies. That's been a while. Mostly movies don't look that good. I think to myself, that'll come out eventually on like Netflix or Hulu, or we got a Fandango thing. You got that? Where you can rent the movies still? And on the one hand, when you rent the movies on Fandango, I think it's $4.99 or $5.99. And, you know, we used to do Blockbuster way back in the day, or Hollywood Video, back when you could get the DVDs at the video store. We used to do that. I don't remember what it cost. I want to say it was like $2 or $3. So now I'm renting a thing for more money, but there's no store and there's no DVD. So I don't get why it costs so much. But the flip of that is, there's no late fees. So maybe at Hollywood Video it was only $2.50 to rent the movie, but when I brought it back 3 days late, it cost me $12. So actually renting the movie from Fandango for $4.99 or $5.99 is saving me money. That's also true of the Redbox. The Redbox was only $1. I don't know if you had Redbox by you. It was like this. It was like a movie store, but a kiosk outside the CVS. And we'd go rent movies from there. It was like $1 or $1.50. And I think it was every day it was late, it cost another $1 until you got to like $20. And then you bought the movie. You could turn it back if you wanted, but they would charge you. So once you get to day 18 or 19, you might as well keep it. We own a few. We own a few Redbox movies by accident. So sometimes we do that. So I see a movie, ad for a movie, and I think, oh, it looks okay. Or interesting. That looks interesting. And then I'm thinking, hey, well, I'll just wait. It'll be free eventually. And then by the time it's out on Netflix or Hulu or any of these things, I forget that I wanted to see it. So I just don't watch them. We got rid of TV about 6 months ago, too. I don't miss it at all. Not at all. But I don't see a lot of the movie ads, because I think the movie ads are mostly on there. But every once in a while I catch a thing going on. I guess Tom Cruise has a new Mission Impossible. Is this like number 6 or 7? I thought Rambo was bad. Mission Impossible is becoming like Freddy Krueger movies. They're going to get to number 13 soon. But somebody said this one's pretty good. I watched a couple of them. I watched the one, the first one. I watched the one, I think, where they were in Scotland for something. Ving Rhames came to like a castle in Scotland. I don't remember what that one was. I watched the one where Tom Cruise went rock climbing and they call him on his sunglasses to tell him that thing is coming and the sunglasses are going to self-destruct. Maybe that was the same one as the castle in Scotland. I don't know. But yeah, they're pretty good. They say this one's going to be better. I don't know. I'll wait. I'll wait it out. We're going to see Mamma Mia instead. Mamma Mia 2. Which Meryl Streep, I heard, is not in it. Which is good because I hate her. I don't hate her movies. I hate her as a person. Normally you hear that the other way around. But she was one of these people who thought it was cool that Roman Polanski would get to come back to America. Even though he was guilty of drugging and anally raping a child. And then ran away to avoid jail time to France. And the French are helping hide him. I don't know how that works. How does that work exactly? When you have a country you're an ally with. And they're harboring a convicted felon in their country. And they won't give him back. Like, why has nobody said, like, you know what, France? Give him back or we're done with you. That's why I'm very suspicious of government and people in power and their motivations. Because they talk a tough game, but they don't do anything. I feel like Trump would do it. I feel like Trump would tell France that he's going to cut them off if they don't give up Roman Polanski. That'd be funny. But the truth is, it should have happened years ago. I think this was in the 70s. But anyway, Meryl Streep said that he should be free to come back to America, and he was a wonderful something. I don't know. Awful. It's an awful thing. Like, how do you... Really? Raped a kid. You're cool with that? Plus, she was friends with Harvey Weinstein. So I'm suspicious of that, too. How much did she know, and when did she know it? So she was in the first movie. Not that she was a big part of it, but she was in the first movie. But I don't think she's in this one, so I'm feeling better about going, thinking she's not in it. So, yeah, so that's it. Listen, I hope you guys have a great weekend. Thanks for tuning in to this Saturday edition of the In the Truck podcast. Go to Amazon.com and buy The Toxic Masculinity Crisis. It's a really good book. Short, quick read. I think that you'll really enjoy it. Have a great weekend, y'all.